Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, part two of our lovely chat with Roisin Murphy. If you haven't heard part one, go listen to it first. If not, here's part two. You moved to Manchester when you were 12 as a family, didn't you?
We did, yeah. That was due to severe financial difficulties. And we had lots of connections in Manchester. We'd already spent lots of summer holidays there, lots of aunties, and my grandma was there, and my father had lived there as a young man for a while, so there was a great connection with Manchester anyway. So I really thrived from that move. I was ripe to go from a small town to a city, I think, at that moment in my life. It was much more difficult for my brother.
Then your family went back to Ireland, right? But you stuck around.
I did, yeah. I got a flat, and it was a lovely flat. In fantastic old Victorian house with a big garden that I could walk straight out onto. And I continued my studies through A-levels. And then I went to Sheffield.
It must have been scary, age 16, or did you just think you knew it all and could do it all?
It was the best time in my life.
Really?
It was an extremely happy time, and I can count that sort of level of happiness on one hand, the times I felt like that. And it was an extremely freeing time, and I was, you know, absolutely safe. The way that I was, the background I'd had, and then the fact that I was being supported by housing benefit, and I was getting money every week, and I was surrounded by friends. It was great. It was just great.
And you had quite a lot of sort of good clubbing experiences around then. It feels like it was slightly your beginnings and access into queer culture.
Listen, I'll tell you what happened to me. I was really into alternative music in that time when I first got my flat. I was only 16, you know, and I was going around with all these, like, Jesus and Mary chain type fellas, you know, and and going to every gig, going to, you know, the weirdo pubs, going to sound systems, going to anything we could get into because we were still very young, you know.
Mm.
And then I kind of moved away from that, and I started going to more kind of like black clubs in Manchester. I started going out with a girl, it was a black girl from my college.
Mm.
To Precinct 13, and then to Moss Side, to like PSV, and even to kind of like blueses and things in Moss Side. And I really got into that. And that's where I really got into dancing, you know, beside a sound system. Then I started going raving a little bit, to actual raves, 17 or 18. When I moved to Sheffield, really, 19, was when I started to be kind of educated as to what had created everything that was going on. So, you know, the DJs that I was listening to were playing a kind of seamless thing of disco through to house, or, you know, or they would play hip-hop and street soul. And then we started going back to Manchester to go to gay clubs.
Right.
And so I was always told by all these kind of elders, if you like, fellas like Parrot and Mark and that in Sheffield, that this was where that music came from, point blank, you know. So then we all started to go. We'd get a bus over to Manchester and go to gay clubs in Manchester. There wasn't that kind of scene in Sheffield. There was one club called Trash that came And that was really good. And it was really amazing, actually. A fantastic amount of fashion going on for somewhere like Sheffield. Also, the earliest experience I had was going to London from Manchester. I think I was 16 on the bus, you know, and staying with a friend down there who's a little bit older, who was staying in a flat that her dad owned on Liverpool Street. And then we went to Trade and queued round the block like three times to get into Trade. Kept getting turned down, went into Trade, got in the end, went in, upstairs, looked down, sea of men with no tops on, pants, lasers pinging everywhere, smoke going everywhere, banging techno, you know. And I said to myself, I am actually home, I'm home. This is it, Babylon, come on.
So Trade was, for anyone listening who doesn't know it, so Trade was, like, correct me if I'm wrong, was it on a Sunday night at Turnmills, or am I dreaming?
Oh, I think it might have been on two nights or three nights over the week. I don't know, but anyway, Saturday, could have been Sunday. It was right through the night, though. They went to the morning.
Yes. You know? It was always...
It was Babylon. For a young girl of that age, let me tell you, that was an eye-opener. But so many people were so sweet to us. And, it was fantastic. I loved it. I couldn't get enough after that.
Well, it's interesting on two counts, really. But one being that you were mentioning people like Parrot and Mark Bryden, who you set up Maloco with, sort of educating you on where this house and disco came from, and that sort of started on the queer scene, right?
Absolutely. I was told that point blank. And, you know, Mark used to say that was the best drugs he'd ever had, was when he was going around with Boy George and the lads, because he did some music. He did some music with him, you know, quite a bit. He worked with him quite a lot, actually, a couple of years before I met him.
Right. As a producer?
Yes, as a producer. I think George tried to turn him. He wasn't having it. And then it all fell asunder, the relationship. But they made some good tunes. And he had the best time of his life, as far as I'm aware, you know, and really soaked it up with that gang in London.
Mm.
He didn't soak it up enough for George's tastes.
But he sort of had a kind of crash course immersion in queer culture then, right? Being around people like Boy George at that time, particularly.
He did, you know, because they had something that they wanted, because they were already doing the house music in 1987. So this would have been like 88, 89. And they, you know, these lads in Sheffield had something them lads in London really wanted. And vice versa, you know, they could show them things and tricks that they'd not seen in Sheffield, if you know what I'm saying. So, but I'm very, going back further, I'm very influenced by glam rock and the whole attitude of glam rock and the whole feeling of... the balls it takes to be a peacock, you know, in let's say in a working class town like Sheffield, and all them lads that became ABC and the Human League, that they would have come up against once they'd sort of slipped into their sister's blouse and put a bit of lipstick on and a bit of eyeliner and a few feathers. They had to totter down to the centre of town, you know.
Yeah.
And run the gamut of whatever was, you know, it was just outrageous for them to be doing that, having just seen David Bowie on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
How could they possibly think they could do that in Sheffield? And things like that. I mean, I find those kind of juxtapositions, and as I said, you know, like when there's a lot of information, conflicting information in the air in that moment, I find those things really exciting and inspirational.
You mentioned saying when you were standing in Trade, that nightclub, and you felt like you'd come home kind of thing. And you've also referred to yourself as a drag queen, right? Which is kind of, you're making me think it when you're talking about the glam rock thing. And if when you first realised that, like, that was a two-way street, that not only... did you love it, but actually the queer community adored you? which they do and have for so long.
Yeah, it was a joy because, you know, it was like saying, okay, everything you're doing, the people who should know whether or not it's working on the level you're trying to make it work seem to be reacting to it. Simple as that, you know, success, fantastic, you know, without wanting to put anyone in a pigeonhole or anything like that. At the end of the day, this fascination I have with the peacocks of the night and the music that goes along with it and the potential in that creatively, because it's doesn't have that kind of macho ego that, you know, rock has, the rock and roll or whatever. It's sort of bit more narrow what can be achieved, and in this culture, in this genre, in this place, there is this great experimentalism, because the music, ironically, the experimentalism comes out of trying to reach the function. So where people sort of get messed up with dance music because they think it's functional and bang, you know, you find the formula and there you have the function at work for you.
Mm.
But it's actually the other way around. It's like we have to keep reinventing the wheel in order to invigorate what connects people to dancing and to make a thing happen. Like jokes, you know, to make a laugh. You can't keep saying the same joke. It stops being funny. So a new joke, yeah. A new joke, and experiment with what's funny, what is funny, what is funny. And the same thing is like the music that makes you dance and is in that world and the whole culture that goes around it is so expressive and expressionistic, you know, and that's what I am.
Mm. Do you think that you have therefore always chosen to go down the road of like innovation, like finding the new joke, as it were, finding the new way of connecting with people through dance music of any kind?
Or any music, really.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit addicted to it. It's a component that although it's scary to be at your depth or to be beyond your own capability sometimes, this is what I try to get to as well. I try to do things that nobody thinks I can do, including myself. That should be a very disquieting feeling. But actually, I find that to be a component of knowing, you know, that if that's there, there's a possibility what I'm doing is good.
But where does that come from? What in you is it that's striving for that, do you think?
I could be a bit insecure, you know. Could be driven by something as stupid as that, as like not feeling like I'm good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it is, it's out of it, I think some great things have come.
100%. I always feel like you're... along with a few other people doing the heavy lifting in pop of remaining avant-garde and experimental while making everybody want to dance, you know?
Yeah, I don't even... It is hard for me, the pop thing, because I don't really like a lot of pop music.
Mm.
It's simple as that. It really is. There's so much music from the past and from the present. Listening to chart music 90% of the time these days I can't get my head around why people would, you know, that, there is music, kind of a music blindness some people have, you know.
Yes.
Really nice people, interesting people. I've got friends who are wonderful, but Jesus, if you give them the Spotify at a party, it's like, what's missing? Where's the missing link? Like, you know, there's a world of music to discover and deeply pleasurable music, music that's extremely expensive and sounds un-fucking believable and changes your molecules and dips you into, like another dimension, you know. There's loads of music like that. And then it's um-tee, you know, it's everywhere you go, it's the same bloody music.
Yes.
So no, the whole pop, the idea of pop truly, ultimately and scarily for anyone who perhaps would like to work with me in the music industry, it just doesn't do it for me, you know. I find it a little bit repulsive. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's interesting.
That's how I feel.
It depends what you define as pop, and I always feel like the best music in the world is pop. You know what I mean? Like, Grace Jones is pop in my head, but it's just done in the best possible way. And I think that, pop actually contains a load of other stuff that is like this traffic jam of people trying to copy the thing in order to, you know, repeat the success of someone who's been strange and avant-garde. Do you know what I mean by that?
You know, I can sit and listen to Britney Spears records and fucking love them up. You know, she's done some unbelievably wicked tunes. You know what I mean? And I am as into that as anyone else ever, you know, etc. And onwards and before and after in pop, yes, obviously. We are at a different time now, though. It is different. It is. It isn't as significant. It doesn't have to hold the same weight of cultural. I don't know, maybe I'll talk about, no, skip it. I don't know, but it doesn't, you know, I'd like to reinvent it, I guess. That's, you know, I'd like to be allowed to reinvent it. Maybe I can reinvent it as an older woman, as a woman who's, you know, seen a bit and done a bit. Maybe my next project can reinvent it in a way that's totally unexpected. I always believe that, you know, in the beginning. I always believe that.
And that's always what you're striving for when you start an album or an EP or whatever, a song of any description?
Yeah, kind of. You know, well, there are other things, many things that I'm trying to do, but it's one of them. It's a good driver, isn't it? You know, it'd be great if I really did something special. And an artist like me has to have this drive. This isn't made in an industrial way. This is made by many collaborators with me, but I'm driving it, you know. And so I have to have the drive myself. Sometimes I'd like to sort of just have a little pub band with Eddie, actually, and just play music for the love of it.
But I feel like you do.
You know, just turn up at the Eight Bells with, you know, a few musicians every now and again. And
do you feel like you've moved towards a version of that? Because I know that you do a lot of your own stuff DIY, like you direct your videos and you're very involved in your artwork and all that stuff. Is that a sort of to do with being frustrated by how the music industry has changed?
No, God, no. It's totally been just a natural thing to do, I think. Just get more and more involved in things. If I do have a little bit of a, you know, pernicketiness about pop music and, you know, pop stars and the whole notion of what all that is and what it's supposed to mean, or that it doesn't mean anything, then I kind of think, well, at least if I'm throwing myself into every channel that this thing, Roisin Murphy, is coming out of, then perhaps it's going to end up meaning something.
Do you feel sometimes like you're treading the line of like trying not to be pretentious, but also wanting to be at the forefront and avant-garde and interesting and trying to find that balance?
I'm absolutely not interested in not being pretentious. It doesn't worry me at all being pretentious. Playing pretend, playing dress up, thinking things, being creative, being open. As long as it doesn't harden into something that's immovable, you know, then, you know, what's wrong with being a bit pretentious?
Yes.
Bit of a little Lord Fauntleroy, poncing around, doing whatever she likes,
What's wrong with that?
I agree, because I think we police a lot of difference, you know what I mean? And I think it can be called pretentious. And it's like, well, is it pretentious or am I just expressing what I think?
You know, also you get that one, keep it simple, stupid. Like sort of some lads in Sheffield who are making music, you know.
Yeah.
Used to sort of spout that one at us. Keep it simple, stupid. And I used to think, well, yeah, I'll keep it simple when I want to keep it simple. And I'll go mad when I want to go mad. And I'll do whatever it is I want to do, actually. And, you know, there was this kind of reactionary moment against allowing musicians to go too free in your music or allowing too much knob twiddling or too much going on, which can be, you know, it's a very sensible thing to keep in mind. Let's not have too much going on. But at the same time, I've been doing it for, what is it now, more than 25 years. And I like to keep it simple when I want to keep it simple. And I'll go complicated when I feel complicated. And you, as the, hopefully, as the listener who might look back over all the years of music that I've made, even ever so sort of briefly and just through, skip through it, you'll find so much, you know, you'll find plenty there to entertain you, different moods you might have and that.
Yes. You told a funny story about fashion and going to the Met Ball.
Well, just, you know, I've done this twice to Anna Wintour, where I've just sort of inadvertently completely ignored her wishes and got nervous and acted weird, basically. And so I got nervous when I got to the queue to get into the bloody thing, which was obviously like a very slow-moving queue with superstars waiting to have their photographs taken.
Mm.
And I just felt ridiculous. I just felt like I'm just going to be forcing the photographers to take my picture and wait an hour and then force them to take my picture between, say, Beyonce and Rihanna.
Mm.
And I was also being accompanied by the guy who runs Diesel, who's also very shy, very nice man, but very shy, and I could sense he was feeling really awkward about the whole thing too. So I just said, let's skip this completely. And we did, and apparently that wasn't the done thing.
Oh, really?
Skip the going through and shaking hands with Anna Wintour and everything. And then there was another time where some lovely guys that I know are amazing designers from New York were in Paris during Fashion Week, and they invited me to the American Vogue apartment where Anna was hosting a kind of intimate soiree. And it was all people, like, she picks these young guys every year, girls that are amazing, and she supports them and everything. And it was all pretty much that type of thing. And I arrived with these two guys, and I just immediately thought, well, I'll get out of the way while they talk business, you know, yourself, like, you know. So I sort of just, she was waiting at the door, and I kind of swerved and turned away and walked straight into the bloody party. And apparently the look on her face was not at all what one would want.
Really?
And so anyway, but there you go. Yeah, but that's the story of my life. I mean, that's like, there's no reason for me to have a connection with fashion, because every time I have a connection with fashion, I do something stupid like that.
But is it that, I suppose, okay, so for the Met Ball, for example, like, people go there, you know, we get all the photos the next morning of everyone on the stairs, and Rihanna's in that dress and Beyonce's in that dress and they look amazing. The actual on the ground reality of that is Beyonce and Rihanna have to queue for like an hour and a half to get on that red carpet, and that is fundamentally weird.
It's fine. It's absolutely fine if the whole world is waiting for that photograph of you and all those photographers are desperate for the photograph. You know, you're doing everybody a favor by waiting there for an hour. But I'm just getting in the way. Like, that's how I felt. And I just nip in and basically get a glass of champagne and try and chill out, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, it's funny because you so aren't getting in the way. People want to see what you're wearing and people are fascinated by you. But
No. I definitely 100% was getting in the way. But I didn't get in the way, you see. So I just slipped and slide. I like to slip and slide. And I like to. I think, you know, going back to my parents as well. And that culture that I was brought up in the late 70s and through the 80s in Ireland, where all classes had sort of almost broken down, really. And the Irish culture is like that. Going to the horse culture, you know, the man is running the lord around in circles. The guy who can deal with the horses is, you know, he's the king. Does not who owns the horses or the stables or whatever have you. And so there's all this like slipping and sliding between different kinds of cultures, or one minute you're with a priest or priests, and the next minute you're drinking with, it could be anybody, you know, it could be Brendan Bean or some old fucker. it could be anyone. And that was the way it was growing up. And I really value being able to slip through cultural and class divides. And I've always been able to do that. My parents have always done it. And it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to us. Irrelevant.
Do you quite like getting into those kind of inner sanctum type spaces like the Met Ball or Anna Wintour's house, but then sort of being the naughty kid there and not quite playing by the rules?
Absolutely. If that's the way it turns out, yeah, I'm all up for that that kind of behavior.
Will you tell me the story that I feel sums you up in many, many ways, but you might disagree, about when you went to a retreat in Ibiza for some R&R?
Oh, God. Well, it was quite a big journey, that one. When I went to the retreat, I was there a day early, and then I went to Pasha. I arrived on a Saturday, went to Pasha that night. I arrived back to the retreat at like 11 o'clock the next morning, and all these lovely yoga people had arrived, and I was wiped out and tried to do the yoga at 5 o'clock in the evening, but then nearly died. So the day after, they were all talking about me, saying, oh, she's arrived, you know, and she's been out partying already. So I got a driver guy to come pick me up, and I threw the bag over the wall. I climbed over the wall and disappeared into the night. I went off into Ibiza for a couple of weeks, staying at different hotels and places and blah, and really on my own, alone. It was a bad time in my life, actually. Although you can be here and just never be alone, in a way. So I met all sorts of people and ended up going on all these different journeys, and one night I was back in Pasha and was about to go home, and the next thing is I ended up in the VIP with Puff Daddy and Khalees and all these amazing people chatting, and time went by, and I ended up on the street outside Pasha at 9 o'clock in the morning when they closed it, with no lift home, and I lived in the north of the island at the time. Started walking down the street in the lovely little Xander Rose dress, with the sun beating down on me, my fair Irish skin in the high heels and the little handbag, crying and just walking, and people just thinking I was a freak. And then some lovely young guy who was on his way to San Antonio in his rental car stopped and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "I'm not okay, I couldn't get a taxi, it was impossible." They all went off. I saw them going off in the blacked out, windowed sort of vehicles, you know. And, that was a wake-up call. That was pretty much time to go back to London then, I thought. You've reached your peak of idiocy. It was one of them when there's been a couple of times I've come back from Ibiza, and it doesn't happen anymore, but it used to happen, where I just thought, at least I'm alive. At least I'm alive, you know, and I'd be walking around Queen's Park with the September sun dappling my head. And I'd be going, I'm alive. I'm actually alive after that. That's amazing.
But it's sort of the reason I love that story. Two reasons. One is that I think it kind of, I wonder if it says more about you in the respect that you like to be part of that Khalees Puff Daddy world. But at the same time,
I'm not at all part of that. I don't like to be part of it. And I'm not part of it, so, you know, but sometimes they, you know, they invite me in, and then they realise I'm not up for the sex parties and all that, and then I get.
Then they don't let you in the limo.
Then anymore, no, she's not going to give out, is she?
But sorry, I don't mean that you like it, but I suppose that it's part of your job in some ways, isn't it? Being a bit of a star, and, you know, being a superstar and hanging out in VIP bits. But then it feels like maybe there's something in all of that that doesn't sit well with you, which is that it's not really to do with the music.
It's not even that. It's knowing that that hasn't actually been necessary for me to still be here talking to you. That is such a success for me. You know, that is such an incredible thing that, you know, I don't have to do that. I don't have to be someone who can't walk around with my children or at the most extreme end of it. But I'm also not somebody who ever had to get tied up or addicted or into some kind of cycle of feeding the monster, or I have got loads of time to be creative, and I've got plenty of people who are interested in what I do creatively, and I've made a life out of it rather than made myself famous, you know. And I think I'm very proud. I'm very proud and delighted it's like that. It's bloody brilliant.
It really is.
Yeah.
It is, and it's also I wanted to ask you about, because it reminded me of the Overpowered video, where, you know, you for anyone who hasn't seen it or, you know, needs a refresher, you know, it starts with you on stage in that amazing outfit. Is it Gareth Pugh, that outfit?
That whole campaign is about that thing you're talking about, that sort of tension between this exhibitionism and a groundedness, you know, something healthy under it, not unhealthy, as you may assume.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd never thought about it like that. Because then in the video, you obviously then go home and you're getting chips on the way home, and then you go into your very normal flat. And then I think my favourite bit of that whole video is that you don't get undressed to get into bed. You get into bed in the outfit.
Yes, that
which is this huge
100% necessary. That was necessary. The album cover is the same in a nutshell. You know, there's me in the good calf, you know, proper calf. You get what you pay for. Nice bit of English breakfast, bit of couture, living La Vida Loca. You know, what else do you want?
But is it sort of an interest in those? What I think is really interesting is, you know, like an interest in the moments in and around the performance that, you know, which relates to the Puff Daddy thing. It relates to the Puff Daddy story, sorry, and that video of, like, you're still it even when you're not on stage. There's moments where everybody else's limo does drive off and you're just still there.
Yeah, I'm still it when I'm not on stage, because when I'm on stage, I'm not pretending.
She's a delight. Loved that chat. Let us know what you thought of it. Email your comments, questions and agony uncles to hello@homosapienspodcast.com. Get in touch. Stay connected on Instagram @homosapiens, Facebook @homosapienspodcast. Next week's episode is Wednesday the 1st of December. Christmas starting. Have you got an advent calendar? Are they sustainable? So many questions. It's World AIDS Day. And so we are joined by Ruth Coker-Burks, and Ruth Coker-Burks is this incredible woman who, in the beginning of the AIDS crisis started looking after men who had AIDS in Arkansas, in America, when nobody would even go near them. They wouldn't go near them, not in hazmat suits. She went in, he went, looked after them unprotected because she knew these people needed love. She then went on to start to bury these men whose families had abandoned them. She took it upon herself to bury them herself by night because nobody would even touch the graves because they thought they were contaminated. This woman is an angel from on high. She is the most extraordinary person I have ever encountered. What she did for people at the beginning of the AIDS crisis is unparalleled. She is talking to us. It is the most incredible story, and it's World AIDS Day, so it's the perfect time to talk to her and to talk about how far we've come, you know? It's so different today as it was way back then. So it's a beautiful episode. Please tune in next week. And thank you very much for listening today. I've finished my coffee. I've finished it all. Thank you. Goodbye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Powered by Spirit Studios.